Chapter 16, Ambrose Gives Up. The hospital they brought the Yetis to was a very famous one in a quiet London square. The nurses were kind and skillful, the doctors clever and comforting, and the matron wasn't the starched and stuffy kind, but a sympathetic person who let Con and Ellen stay with the Yetis all day long, because she knew that people can't get well if they are separated from those that they love. The Yetis had become very famous after the children's protest outside the palace and the rescue by the seaplanes of the British Antarctic Territory research station, and the nurses were kept busy shooing journalists and cameramen out of the wards. Perry had gone down to Somerset to look for his pig farm, but Con and Ellen had to have a police escort when they went to and from the hospital because of the newspaper dogging them. And every night on television there was a bulletin about the Yetis, and when it was on the streets emptied, and bicycles and footballs were abandoned, and children all over the country went inside to watch the news. At first the news was grave. Lucy was very ill with pneumonia, and Uncle Otto's wound was so deep that he had to have a long and difficult operation to remove the bullet. Both his and Lucy's bed had the curtains drawn round them, while doctors and nurses hurried backwards and forwards with syringes and trays of medicine and thermometers. But slowly, they both got better. They could tell that Lucy had turned the corner when she asked the nurses for a mirror and started worrying about the state of her stomach. "It's my pigtail," she murmured groggily. "They're all undone." So the nurses, neat as only nurses can be, made her two lovely flaps all ready for Queen Victoria if they found her again. After that, Lucy managed to say sorry to a plate of soup which the ward maid had brought her. The next morning she said sorry to three boiled eggs, some grilled tomatoes and the bunch of marigolds in a vase beside her bed. After that she was reckoned to be out of danger. Uncle Otto's wound, too, healed well. Soon he was walking on crutches, looking somehow very manly and distinguished, as people on crutches are apt to do. And it was now something that very, very nice that happened to him. The clever doctors had found something to rub into his ball patch which wasn't toothpaste or honey or cream cheese, but a real medicine which somehow they had just invented to make hair grow. And almost day by day, as he lay in bed reading the books the kind library lady had brought him on a trolley, they could see the soft dark down which covered his domed head, it grew steadily longer and stronger. Grandma, of course, loved being in hospital. Being old, she had quite a lot of interesting things wrong with her, like heartburn and fibroids and wind, which everybody in the hospital took seriously instead of just saying, "We must expect a few troubles as we get older," like Lady Agatha used to say. A lot of doctors came to see Clarence too, and put electrodes in his brain, and tried to make him read things. When the others explained that Clarence's brain had been damaged when he was little, and that he was very happy as he was, they all loved him, and sensibly left him alone. With everything going so well, with messages coming in that the hunters had been turned out of Farley Towers, and the proper owner was coming back, with Mr. Bellamy phoning to say that the children could stay as long as necessary, Con and Ellen should have been as happy as could be. But in fact, they were worried sick. And what they were worried about was Ambrose. In the hospital, when the Yetis first came, they hadn't taken too much notice of Ambrose. He didn't have pneumonia like Lucy, or a gaping wound like Uncle Otto. He wasn't old like Grandma, and bits of his brain weren't missing like Clarence's. A bit of rest and warmth, thought the staff, and Ambrose, who was young and strong, would soon be himself again. But Ambrose didn't get well and strong, and Ambrose wasn't himself again. When Con pointed out to the nurses that he wasn't eating at all, they told him not to worry. Young people often go off their food, especially after a shock. Just take no notice. So the children tried not to make a fuss as Ambrose sent away trayfuls of eggs and chips, of castle puddings and banana custard. They tried not to worry when Ambrose lay there with his blue eye dull and sunken and his brown eye glazed and staring at the ceiling. They tried not to worry when Ambrose couldn't even look up at the telly, though they were showing a Tom and Jerry cartoon. "Shall I tell you a story, Ambrose?" Con begged, but Ambrose just shook his great shaggy head and sighed. From the first moment she had found him, wall-eyed and crumpled and desperate to be loved, Lady Agatha had known that Ambrose wasn't quite like the others. "I really think you could kill Ambrose by thinking unkind thoughts about him." she had said to Conn in the valley of Namvidar. Since then, Ambrose had seen the people come over the ice with guns. He had seen his uncle shot. He had known hatred. And now he turned his face to the wall and prepared to die. In a week or so, the doctors and nurses became worried too. There was talk of force feeding and drips and things which made the children's blood run cold when they heard of them. And on the news bulletins now, it was announced that though the other four Yetis were improving steadily, there was slight concern about the youngest, Ambrose the Abominable. After a few more days, the slight concern was changed to serious concern. At night, the doctors made Ellen sleep in a spare room. She was so exhausted from the strain. But nothing could shift Conn. He sat by Ambrose's bed, murmuring to him, telling him jokes, begging for Lady Agatha's sake, for Father's sake, to make an effort, to eat something, to get well. But Ambrose just said, "People are not my brothers," and grew steadily weaker and more lifeless and ill. Until a day came when the television newscaster looked out of the screen in a very serious way and said, "It is feared that there is little hope for the youngest of the Yetis. Ambrose the Abominable is now seriously ill at Park Square Hospital, London." In the silent hospital, Conn sat by Ambrose's bed, trying to believe the unbelievable. There was no hope. It was going to happen. Ambrose the Abominable was going to die. All day, children had thrown the square outside and stood silently, their faces turned to the hospital windows, waiting for the news. Now it was night. Out in the corridor, the sister on duty sat in her glass cubicle, guarding the white and disinfected room where Ambrose lay. Inside the room, there was no sound. Even the sewing of the ventilator had ceased. Ambrose's eyes were closed. His breath would not have stirred a feather. It could not be long now. Suddenly, in the corridor outside, there was a scuffle, and then a voice, high and sharp and bossy, saying, "Let me go! Let me go at once!" The door opened, and a girl came into the room. She was about Conn's own age, with long fair hair and grey eyes. She was wearing faded jeans and an old sweater, and a haversack hung over one shoulder. "Is that Ambrose?" she said, still in at that loud, high voice, pointing to the bed. Conn nodded, frowning at her to be quiet. Where on earth had he heard a voice like that? And why was her face so familiar? "Who are you?" he said. "I'm Aggie. I came as soon as I heard. They called me up in some beastly boarding school in Switzerland and I had to get back." She went over to the bed and stood looking down at Ambrose. "He's bad, isn't he?" Yes, Conn had stopped, trying to think where he could have seen the girl before. What did it matter? What did anything matter? Aggie put down her haversack. And then she bent over Ambrose and still in that high, clear, governessy voice said, "And what, pray, do you think you are doing?" Conn glared at her. No one had ever spoken above a whisper in that room for days. Yet something held him back for interfering. "Open your eyes at once," the bossy voice went on. "And your earlids. You're supposed to have been brought up as a Farlingham. Let's see you behave like one." To Conn's amazement, a flicker passed over Ambrose's face. A chink of blue appeared, and then a chink of brown. The left earlid wavered. "That's better. And what does one do when a lady comes into the room?" "Stand up," came a thread of voice from the bed. "Quite right, so you can sit up for a start." And unbelievably, Ambrose really did begin to move up on the pillow, almost to raise his head. "I suppose you realise that dying is very bad manners," the relentless girl went on. "Is it?" "Certainly is. And what are manners for?" "Making people comfortable," Ambrose managed to bring out. "Exactly. Well, who's going to be comfortable if you die?" said Aggie briskly. "Sad that that's what they're going to be. What's that by your bed?" "It's my milk." "Your milk? Standing there gathering dust? I'm surprised at you, Ambrose. Drink it up at once," said Aggie, sounding more than ever like an old-fashioned governess. I can't." "Can't, Ambrose? Or do you mean won't?" She took the glass and put it in Ambrose's hands. Then she raised his head from the pillow and put her own hand under it for support. And Conn, who had understood at last what it was all about, looked on, blinking back tears, while Ambrose said weakly, "Yes, Lady Agatha. I'm sorry, Lady Agatha," and drank his milk. Every single drop. Now, I thought that was the last chapter, but we've actually got another chapter. So on Thursday, you will have the last chapter, and it's called Home.